It's time to breathe easier this allergy season with Breathe Right Nasal Strips. With instant nasal congestion relief for up to 12 hours, you can spend your time on your terms, not on your noses. Stuffy nose from outdoor allergens? No problem. We got you. Allergy season just turned into stripping season. Instant relief from nasal congestion anytime, anywhere. Need more convincing? Click the banner below and get a free sample. Breathe Right. Get your strip on. Use as directed.
Whether you're making the same breakfast that you have every day or baking a cake for an extra special day, eggs are a staple in our diets. Eggland's Best eggs are nutritionally superior to ordinary eggs, containing more vitamins and 25% less saturated fat. Not only are they better for you, but Eggland's Best eggs taste better too. There's a reason that they're America's number one eggs. Visit egglandsbest.com for additional information and delicious recipes.
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries, plus napkins, plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this, plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I'm Dr. Fiona Lovely, and this is the Not Your Mother's Menopause podcast. I'm taking the taboos of menopause and perimenopause and bringing light to the dark. No bullshit, no shame. It's time for us to gain a new paradigm in female health, out with the old and in with the new, and I'm bringing fresh perspectives from someone in the arena. I've been practicing women's health for nearly 20 years, and I'm spilling the tea on what it means to live at midlife, knowing that the best is yet to come. I'm sharing my Gen X approach to living through this transition, sassy, a bit sweary, and always honest. Tactical tips and instantly usable information is my aim. I hope to make you laugh and that you learn something new that helps you embrace the change. Together, we bring power to the peri. Onward to the podcast. Welcome to the Not Your Mother's Menopause podcast. I'm Dr. Fiona Lovely. Thank you for taking the time to have a little listen today. I have another really interesting interview to share with you today. Recently, I got to speak with Dr. Gregory Kelly. And yes, he's the first guy on the podcast that I interviewed, so you know it's going to be good. He is the director of product development at Neurohacker Collective, a naturopathic physician, and the author of the book Shapeshift. With extensive experience in both natural medicine and nutrition, Dr. Greg Kelly has been an influential figure in the field. He has served as the editor of the journal Alternative Medicine Review and taught advanced clinical nutrition, counseling skills, and doctor-patient relationships at the University of Bridgeport College of Naturopathic Medicine. Dr. Kelly has also published hundreds of articles on natural medicine and nutrition, contributed 3 chapters to the textbook of natural medicine, and has over 30 journal articles indexed on PubMed. His areas of expertise include nootropics, that's brain supplements, anti-aging and regenerative medicine, weight management, sleep, and the chronobiology of performance and health. Additionally, he's helped develop some rare and powerful compounds that have scientifically shown senolytic activity. Don't worry, listen to the episode. We talk about senolytics at length. And which have a wider range of mechanisms that than existing senolytic supplements available. So this is an episode for my science-minded listeners. We go deep on the science. It's such an interesting conversation around aging and longevity and being able to pull the levers of living well, no matter what your age is. I will be speaking about this more on the podcast going forward as I'm getting more interested in longevity medicine. But Dr. Greg Kelly is one of those pioneers in supplementation in particular, things that help with the aging process, life experience, as I like to call it. So, pen and paper ready, lots of information here, and be sure to check out the show notes where the Neurohacker Collective has given my listeners a coupon code for any supplements you might decide you wish to order from them. So, that said, I can't wait for you to hear this episode. If you want the video of Dr. Kelly and I having a conversation and the videos of all the interviews I do, check out my Patreon page. It's patreon.com/Dr. Fiona Lovely, and all of those are available to you there. So without further ado, here's Dr. Kelly and I having a conversation, but first a word from our sponsors. Hi again. I just want to take a moment to tell you about a webinar I am hosting on women's brain health at midlife. Now, this is the third time I have offered this particular training. It's very popular and I'm pretty excited about it. As always, I just think this is such critical information for women. So let's get it out there. The class is free. It's going to be about an hour. It's on September 9th at noon Mountain Time. And you can sign up for that Women's Brain Health webinar on my website at drlovely.com under the Offerings tab. Or you can pop into the show notes below and there will be a link for you to sign up. I can't wait to see you there. I'm really excited about the information I'm sharing this year. It just keeps evolving. It just keeps getting better and better. And this is my own journey with brain health and my own journey with a family history of both Alzheimer's and dementia and also symptomatic perimenopause where there were days my brain wasn't working so well. So this is what I have done myself to correct the problem and to share, really. And this is a big topic. I talk about it a lot in the office, so I know it's an important one for women. I'd love to see you there. Again, pop down to the show notes below and there will be a registration link. And yes, if you can't make it live, although please try to make it live. It's always so much more fun for me when people are there live listening to the content. If you can't make it live, we'll send out a replay. So share it with your friends and family. And thanks for listening to the podcast. Our next partner is AG1, the daily foundational nutrition supplement that supports whole body health. I drink it every day in the morning to break my fast. It makes me feel like I'm doing something good for my body, that I'm covering my nutritional bases. This simple daily habit allows me to cover those nutritional bases no matter what the day brings. Oh my gosh, because we never know what the day is going to bring. AG1 is a foundational nutritional supplement that delivers comprehensive nutrients to support whole body health, replacing your multivitamin, probiotic, and more in one simple drinkable habit. So if you want to take ownership of your health, it starts with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first purchase. Go to drinkag1.com/Fiona Lovely. That's drinkag1.com/Fiona Lovely. You can find the link in the show notes. Check it out. Okay, welcome to the podcast, Dr. Gregory Kelly. This is the Not Your Mother's Menopause podcast. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me today. Pleasure to be here. Thank you. Well, I'm so excited about this conversation, just doing a little research about you and reading your bio. And I'd love for you to tell us about your naturopathic journey. What brought you to the field of naturopathic medicine?
So I'm going to make this pretty brief if I can, but I started out after university time period as an officer in the U.S. Navy and served about 5.5 years active duty. This was in the mid to late 80s under Reagan's years as the president in the U.S. And towards the end, I had to give a fairly long, I guess, notice that I wasn't going to re-up. So I had about 10 months to a year that I had said, okay, I'm not going to take new orders. I'm going to get out. What am I going to do next? And what I had decided on is I'm just going to be a gypsy. I'll get rid of everything, have a backpack, and just kind of wander around. And to be able to do that, it occurred to me I should be able to do a bare minimum of self-care things, you know, like do things to stay healthy so I wouldn't get sick, you know, be able to do things if I did get sick that would be, you know, kind of, you know, maybe better suited for things now we would think of as natural medicine. And so I started just on my own to read books that, you know, introduced me to things like your background, chiropractic care, acupuncture, herbs. I'd already been interested in both exercise and nutrition from earlier in the Navy. And so it really all merged together there. And when I was like transitioning between the Navy time period and the Gypsy time period, I was in Hawaii and stumbled upon naturopathic doctors and thought, wow, how cool. They're doing all these things I've been reading about all in one profession. So I zigged. And instead of, you know, like becoming a long-term gypsy and wandering the earth, I went to naturopathic school and, you know, started that in 93, graduated in 96, and have been, you know, in the health field ever since. So I guess, like, long story short, it started off because of like this very selfish need to want to be healthy and stay healthy as I, you know, moved around the world.
Wow. So we all have our journey about, you know, what it is we need in our lives and who it is that has influenced us. And you found those naturopathic doctors in Hawaii. It was a chiropractor for me when I was a kid. So I love those early life influences. So grateful for them now, for sure.
Yeah. And you know, back when I went to naturopathic school, there was still, at least in Arizona where I went to school, some of the old timers were chiropractic, naturopathic doctors. They'd gone to one of the few chiropractic schools that also offered the dual degree. And, you know, their bread and butter was for sure chiropractic care, but they were also really great sources of old naturopathic lore as well.
Are any of those schools still around?
I don't think so. There used to be, was it the one in Chicago, National, that
yes.
was the last one that
okay.
offered both, I believe. Well, I think that's where these ones had got their naturopathic degree. But what ended up happening is when naturopathic rebirth, it was rebirthed as National College in Portland, Oregon.
Ah, okay.
By some people. At that point, my understanding is most of these were dual licensed chiropractor NDs that started that there. And so I think all the naturopathic ones are probably self-contained. The only one that had a chiropractic connection was University of Bridgeport, which is one of the fairly newer ones,
yeah.
but it was under the College of Health Sciences and then under the chiropractic wing of that. I taught there for a couple semesters, and we thought of ourselves at that point as like the neglected stepchild of the chiropractic wing of the college. So.
Oh, there's much we could say about that, how chiropractors fit in on all of that. But my question to you is, for the listeners, what's the biggest difference between naturopathic medicine and allopathic medicine or traditional medicine?
I think naturopaths would historically have said several things. One would be philosophical outlook, like our almost how they would understand a problem. So as an example, when I was going through my naturopathic degree time period, I still did Navy reserves. And periodically, once a year, as part of the reserves, you'd go 2 weeks somewhere and be on active duty. And one of mine, I finagled a week being in the, like trailing around a medical doctor, an MD, on a ship. And they felt like what they were doing was treating the cause. Their idea of cause would have just been different than a naturopath's idea of a cause. And maybe different than some chiropractic sense of what the ultimate cause. And so I think that's when I say like philosophy principles, that, you know, often the way we understand a problem is largely, at least strongly influenced, if not determined, by our paradigm of what's causing it. So naturopaths, you know, just fundamentally, their cause has much more, would have been thought of as vitalism back in the day, like this idea that there's some vitalistic force inside, and I would say mitochondria are probably the closest to that in modern science, and that if we do things to improve that, generally health improves. You know, so it was, the old timers were more generalists, right? They would work on diet, movement, getting exposure to bright light, sunsets, use of hot and cold water. So they, you know, a lot of things now that are the fundamental things that biohackers do were the old vitalistic things. And my guess is they work for the same, you know, general reasons, right? They're giving signals to our body clock. They're toughening up mitochondria. So anyways, naturopathic would have been traditionally that, and more modern naturopathic is very akin to what the functional medicine branch of allopathic medicine has emerged, you know, a keen understanding and appreciation of biochemistry, you know, and things to just essentially improve physiology so it's much more, you know, normalized and resilient.
Well, the listeners of this podcast hear me say the words root cause medicine quite often. And I think that's ultimately what you're talking about, is finding the source of whatever imbalance is causing the symptomatology. Yes?
Yes. Yep. And like I said, it would just, so like one of the things on that time on the ship, their idea of what was causing asthma for the workers on the ship was exposure to the, you know, the fumes, the metal particles, all these other things. And that treating the cause was doing something to relax. Where I think you and I would say, well, no, the cause is deeper than that, right? It's the exposure to these things. Yeah. And maybe even deeper than that, because not everyone that got exposed suffered from symptoms. Like, you know, the other things these people were doing outside of that exposure window, right? So the root cause can be elusive. And again, I think often it's, you know, driven by your sense of your philosophy on things. And I think, yeah. Oh, I was just going to say, like, you and I would agree much more commonly on the root cause maybe than a more conventionally trained allopathic doctor.
Absolutely. And this is the art of medicine, whether it's traditional or naturopathic or chiropractic, it's looking to see where is the root cause and how you find it. You know, that's the art of it, which is a beautiful thing. And we all do it differently, which is, you know, can make it a bit frustrating when someone's used to a certain kind of care and then ends up transitioning to a different practitioner. We all do it a little bit differently. You know, Michelangelo didn't paint the same way Da Vinci did, right? This is the art of it. But so you study aging, am I right?
Yeah, so my current position, I'm director of product development at a company called Neurohacker Collective. And we started out very focused on the brain. So the things, you know, really over the last 5 years that I've spent the most time on have been the brain and then the longevity space, with kind of side trips into immunity, the gut-brain axis, you know, lots of pretty cool areas. But for sure, the you know, current state of what's going on in longevity would be something that I feel very plugged in on.
Yes, interesting. So would you call that geroscience then?
Some people call it that. Some, you know, anti-aging is others. You know, I think anti-aging among the more science-based people in it, they don't love that term, because they'll think more of, you know, how can we promote healthy aging? They're not thinking at this point of, oh, we'll get people to live an extra 50 years or something. Well, it's more like the quality of that tail end and, you know, and helping more people achieve, say, like 100 years or whatever, you know, like their you know, potential is, but then getting to enjoy that tail end much more than would commonly be the case currently.
So anti-aging medicine, or saying anti-aging, those words seem to be associated somehow with our physical appearance, whether we have wrinkles or age spots. So, you know, maybe avoiding that is probably part of saying, okay, this is not about Botox shots or fillers. It's about actually looking at the cells and how healthy they are.
Yeah. And I think, like, speaking of just the superficial experience, like one of the I guess, ways to think about aging is, you know, like, how would we measure it, or how would we get a sense of it? And so there's almost, you know, different things. So you can look at function, which would be a big part of functional medicine, right? Measuring hormones, biomarkers, other things, and saying, okay, well, these, your levels of these are not consistent with a super healthy person. You know, so I think of that as functional age. And one of the devices that we use occasionally at our office, it's called the age meter, but it just does a lot of cognitive testing as an example. And as we get older, as just a single example in our brain, our ability to hear the highest tone, like the highest audible pitch, decreases each progressively. So if someone functionally can still hear a higher, you know, pitch tone at 60 than an average 60-year-old, functionally, that part of their nervous system is healthier, if that makes sense, right? So there's functional age. Then there's, you know, an emergence of tests that would be called biological age. So these are things like true age or grim age. They're things that try to look at methylation patterns mostly on our cells and say, okay, this, your biological age, so of yourself and of what genes they're expressing, looks, you know, as a match to your birth age, or you look younger. And so, you know, that's another way, that biological age. But then a big one is perceived age. And that's, you know, it, some, like if we got 10 random strangers to just look at a picture of me, how old would they think I am? And each of these, and the last one, I guess, would be felt age. So if I said, you know, Dr. Lovely, how old do you feel? And that's probably the least predictive, because people are always like, well, I feel way younger than I am. But 13. But each of those is predictive in a sense, right? Ideally, you want your functional age, your biological age, and your perceived age all to be younger than your chronological or birth age. And I think what happens, especially with the perceived age, people focus on the wrong thing. So Botox is an example. There's a lot of women, especially that are Botoxed here in Southern California, and my brain doesn't connect that with looking younger at all. It just doesn't, right? That part of our brain that does the perceived age is too ancient to be fooled by something modern, like, oh, we'll just get rid of wrinkles around the forehead or eyes. Wow. So, you know, so perceived age, what's much more important to that part of our brain are things like the glow of the skin and, you know, like a sense of almost the vitality we get looking at someone. And all that comes, you know, is built from the inside out, from cells and mitochondria.
Wow.
So I think, you know, we miss the mark going on those super superficial things, because our brain just does not translate those into like, oh, this person looks 10 years younger.
Yeah.
But if they were in way better shape or much more vital, then our brain right away makes that translation.
Isn't that fascinating? So you've spoken about a lot of the biopsychosocial aspects of longevity right there in that statement. So if we're talking about the things, the levers that we can pull that affect how well we age, or our longevity, or our health span, as it were, talk to me about those. What are the most important ones?
Well, there's two huge camps within the anti-aging community. One would be biased towards thinking that aging is primarily driven by damage accumulation. So, in simple sense, as we get older, more and more damage accumulates in our cells, mitochondria, and ultimately our tissues. And that the goal then is to either repair the damage or get rid of things that were damaged and replace them with new growth. And then the other camp would be what's often referred to as programmed aging. So this idea that genes, as an example, that would be perfectly suited to, you know, help humans reproduce, but might have a side effect of eventually, you know, causing us to age, wouldn't have been unselected in evolution, right? So we're, in a sense, programmed to age a bit. And I think there's actually elements of truth in both camps. But fundamentally, in terms of then executing on those things, currently, I would say the damage repair and removing accumulated damage is winning the race in terms of things we can do. And then I think a lot of lifestyle things slow the progression of age. So sleep is an example, right? Like, we know now pretty definitively sleep is doing all kinds of wonderful things while we're sleeping, right? It's you know, there's this thing called the glymphatic system that is almost like detoxing or cleansing our brain each night when we're in deep sleep. And the ability to get there and have this process go on is strongly associated with having better memory as we get older, like not having that age-related brain issues. And in terms of the damage accumulation, I think the most advanced thing in the pipeline are what are called senolytics currently.
Yes, please tell us about those.
Yeah, so the analogy I often use would be like, you know, for the audience listening, imagining a plant. I can see a beautiful one in the background while I'm speaking to you right now. But now imagine like one of those leaves started to yellow a little bit, right? So it's no longer as vital as, you know, a super healthy leaf. And what happens in our tissues is cells are constantly stressed by different things. That's, you know, no problem. They have built-in, you know, almost software programs to deal with stress. So the first thing invariably, no matter what the stress, maybe it's, you know, inadequate nutrition or radiation or, you know, chemicals, cells will invariably always respond initially by, you know, upregulating things like antioxidant differences. You know, they'll make more glutathione. They'll try to do things to prevent damage. And oxidative stress is fundamentally, no matter what the stress is, some degree of that translates into cells as oxidative stress. And if stress is more than can be adapted to by that, then often some things will get damaged, right? Mucked up a little bit. And what inside our cells tends to get damaged are what are called organelles. So organelles are like the things inside cells, like the factories that make our genes, mitochondria, those would be organelles. And so what most typically happens is the protein components of those get misfolded or they get, you know, dysfunctional. And so that's the next sequence of what cells do is it's called autophagy, but they'll find these damaged, misfolded proteins and recycle them. And autophagy is a big reason that, you know, some of the people that focus on healthy aging do things like intermittent fasting or periodic fast. And then if stress is even more than that, then what happens often is the whole cell gets somewhat damaged. And at that point, you know, recycling things inside it just wouldn't be sufficient. So one of two things typically happens. If the stress is crazy severe, so, you know, you're bitten by a brown recluse spider or a snake bite, right? You'll get necrosis. Like that's kind of unplanned death of cells. If a cell has, you know, less harmonic damage, but still a lot, then it would go through what's called apoptosis. And that's like a intentional cell death. It's programmed cell, they think about it. But in advance of the cell dying, it's an orderly process. And apoptosis, and again, I'll mention your plant, comes from a Greek word that means literally falling off in the sense of a fruit falling off a tree or a leaf falling off the plant, right? So it's the natural just falling away process where the cell, I guess literally would be something that would fall out of our tissues and then be replaced by a new cell. And if the damage isn't quite enough to cause apoptosis, but more than autophagy, then what happens is senescence. And senescence fundamentally means the cell is no longer able to divide or replace itself. So it's a cell that's not living. It would be, in the plant analogy, like a yellow leaf on your plant that for whatever reason did not fall off, did not go through that natural process. And so what scientists have found, and most of this started recently in 2011 and since then, is that as organisms get older, senescent cells accumulate in multiple tissues. And they've now been linked to almost any health condition you can name that's worse with aging, senescent cells play some role in, which makes sense. This would be naturopathic principle. The health of tissues is dependent on the health of the cells in those tissues. So imagine the plant in your home or your garden. Now, you know, it goes from, you know, you're age 20, every leaf on it, vibrant green, you know, you're 30, oh, this one's yellowing a little bit. You know, now you're 50, 60, like, wow, like why are a third of the leaves yellow and not, you know, falling off the plant? And so as a gardener, what you would do is prune those away. And the goal of pruning in as a gardener would be, one, by removing that unhealthy leaf, it makes room now on the plant for new growth, for like a more vibrant leaf. Two, the yellowing leaves were sucking up resources. Even though they're not contributing to the health of the planet, there's the plant, they're still using a lot of resources. And so the idea of senescent cells accumulating is very akin to that. As an example, it was one study in baboons that found out by late in their life, about 15% of the cells in various tissues were senescent. So they were taking up phase, but not contributing to health. And one of the other things senescent cells do is they give off a lot of compounds into the environment around them that can cause other cells nearby to be dysfunctional. It's sometimes why they're thought of as zombie cells. They can cause other nearby things to almost become senescent as well. And again, going back to the plant metaphor, that would be common, right? If you have a yellow leaf that you don't prune away, it will attract pests and other things that can then spread to nearby leaves. So what happened in 2015 is scientists at Mayo Clinic and at Scripps Institute of Aging in Florida found that there were certain compounds, if given to animals, acted to cause these stuck senescent cells to finally go through this natural falling off process and be removed from cells. And when that happened, it rejuvenated tissue. The older animals became much more biologically healthy. So they, functionally started to do things consistent with just being much healthier and almost younger animals. So that research led to the Mayo and Scripps naming compounds that do that as senolytics. So senolytics, for the audience, would be fundamentally think of it as things that help these stuck senescent cells in our tissues finally complete that journey to where they fall off and make room in our tissues for stem cells to create new, healthier, younger versions of ourselves. So that was a lot of information. So hopefully I didn't overwhelm the audience.
It was great. I was thinking if I need to have a paper written, I'm going to ask you to come and help me because that was beautiful. You brought it all together. I don't think I could ask a question about it, but I'm going to try. So senescent cells are part of this whole inflammaging thing that's being talked about. Is that correct?
Yeah, they're arguably the single most important factor driving it. When I said they secrete a lot of things into the environment around them, most of those we would think of as inflammatory cytokines and other inflammatory compounds.
Okay.
And then the original work on inflammaging, it was someone that looked at liver tissue. And fundamentally, if you gave, liver tissue from a 70-year-old and a 25-year-old to, a pathologist to look at, it would be super easy for them to tell which one's the 70-year-old and which one's the 25-year-old. And a lot of that is because the older liver tissue will have been infiltrated with immune cells, mostly macrophages. And so that originated the idea of inflammaging. And what senescent cells do is they call in a lot of immune cells into the area where they are. And often because of the signals they're putting out, those immune cells just stay chronically there, causing, instead of doing the cleanup and regeneration that the immune system should do, you get this low level, what's now called inflammation, low level ongoing immune system activation.
And that cellular cleanup is meant to be done via things like the glymphatic system, which my podcast listeners are familiar with that because we do talk about that. It's the dishwasher of the brain is how I refer to it. And, or at least how I've heard it referred to and passed that along, but also autophagy, apoptosis, which you have mentioned. Now we do talk a lot about intermittent fasting or time-restricted eating on this podcast and the benefits of it. And autophagy is probably my favorite of those benefits. So and you may have said this, but we were down a rabbit hole, so it was great, but tell me again, please, is autophagy not enough, or the natural process of cell death not enough to take care of these senescent cells? Why are they hanging out?
Yeah, so autophagy would be the way I think of it. So autophagy, senescence, these are stress response programs, right, that cells have. Autophagy would be the one enacted when stress has left and can still be repaired, or when damage from the stress is left and can still be repaired. So it's an anti-senescent. So the idea of autophagy is, let's clean things up before it gets so bad that we execute senescence and stop this cell from dividing and making new copies. Senescence, at some point, the damage is so severe that the cell, and this is, you know, me speaking for the cell, but ultimately I'm just guessing, but scientists think it's so that the cell is damaged enough, it doesn't want to risk making copies of itself that would be damaged. So it, senescence freezes it as it is. And then what should happen with a senescent cell, and this would classically be the norm in a 20-year-old, right? So as an example, a 20-year-old decides, well, I'm going to do way more intense exercise today than I usually do. They'll make some senescent cells as part of that. It's absolutely normal, healthy. But what would happen if we looked, you know, a couple of days to a week later, they would all have been cleared out of the tissue. And by cleared out, what I mean is the senescent cells would have come in, called some immune system in to help, you know, repair and regenerate from the, you know, more extensive exercise than that person was used to. And then the senescent cells would have been frozen, but they would still have then gone through apoptosis. And the ones that didn't, the immune system would find them and gobble them up and take them out, right? So a young person would make senescent cells naturally, but their half-life is really short. They do a job and then they're gone. But what happens with aging, and this is for a variety of reasons, is we would, you know, I'm 61. If I did that same, like, step up in exercise that I'm not used to and stressed out my tissues myself, I would make senescent cells, but more of them would linger. A week later, they'd still be there. So they would have done their job and not gone through apoptosis. The stragglers, the immune system may have missed because of something called immunosenescence, but basically, you know, our immune system becomes less great at finding stress cells as we get older. And so there's a combination of reasons, but the main reason that senescent cells accumulate progressively as we age is the ones that are lingering. So I tend to differentiate transient versus lingering. Young people make them, but they're transient. They do their job, they're gone. As we get older, we have more of these lingering ones that fundamentally didn't fall off the plant. And the reason they linger is thought to be a combination of things. One is we make more variants of senescent cells as we get older that have what are called senescent cell anti-apoptotic pathways. Super complex word, but SCAP is how they refer to them. But fundamentally what that means is these variants of senescent cells have figured out a way not to go through apoptosis. So they resist that process. And senolytics are usually targeted at renormalizing that SCAP network, so they finally do go through apoptosis. So that's one reason they're fundamentally resistant to going through the process that they should. Another is that idea that the immune system's just not great at finding the stragglers, so more stragglers build up. And then the third reason, or a third reason, is that idea of, you know, sending out these inflammatory markers. So this is called secondary senescence, but just like a yellowing leaf on a plant can drop past but then pop to another leaf and cause that to now yellow, senescent cells can cause nearby cells to become senescent that otherwise would have been healthy. So that's called secondary senescence, or sometimes the bystander effect. And then the last reason gets into that idea of programmed aging, that our genes are just programmed to create more senescent cells as we get older. And you can find evidence that supports all four of those. And my guess is it's not one of them, it's some combination of all. But for the audience, the long story short is predictably, you know, no matter what you're doing to stay healthy, you'll progressively accumulate some senescent cells in various tissues as the decades march on.
Okay, and if we've got that, then what do we do about the senescent cells? How do we manage this, please?
Yeah, so that's where I think that, you know, you need the gardener or someone to come in and prune them away. And that brings us to this idea of senolytics. So senolytics specifically are things that like renormalize that SCAP network, that ability for the senescent cell to finally go through this journey to falling off apoptosis. And so the original two that Mayo studied and named this category for, one's a chemotherapeutic drug called dasatinib. It's used mostly in blood cancers. And one's quercetin, which I'm sure you've used, you know, through your practice. It's been, you know, a dietary supplement. And quercetin, the quer part of it comes from the word oak, right? So it would have been something that accumulated, you know, in leaves of oak, bark of oak. And what's been interesting is that several of the most promising senolytic compounds that would be in the dietary supplement or plant world instead of a pharmaceutical drug are things that would predominate in bark and leaves. You know, so fitsitin is another one, luteolin is another. And these luteolin, quercetin, fitsitin, these are all yellow pigments. That's what they were used like way before, you know, dietary supplement companies exist. If you went back, you know, to the Middle Ages, they would have used these compounds to create dyes. So luteolin, the lute, that's, I think it's Latin for yellow. Fichtetin comes from a German word that was a yellow dye, like piece in holes or something like that. And so my intuition, and I could be completely wrong at this, but when humans evolutionarily were exposed to times of famine, we would actually eat whatever was in our environment, right? Grass, leaves, bark, just to have something to fill our stomach. And my guess is that when we drastically increase the amount of these particular flavonoids in our diet, it triggers an evolutionary program that says, oh, famine is imminent or famine's already here. Let's get rid of everything that's not necessary. And so fundamentally what's happening with these plant compounds, when you consume them, they're working on what are called nutrient sensing pathways inside cells. They're sensing the nutrients in the environment and then toggling the cell saying, okay, you know, should I linger? Should I go through apoptosis? Well, the environment's not great. You know, let's flick the switch and we'll, you know, we're already damaged. Let's, you know, finish the journey, falling off. So I think that's what, you know, part of the reason why they work. And what's interesting is a lot of these compounds, so all three I named, also support autophagy, because autophagy also has an element of nutrient sensing. If a cell senses again, and this is why you would do something like, you know, a period, like the fasting mimicking diet, Walter Longo's 3 to 5 day plan, or even, you know, the intermittent fasting, the time restricted eating, the idea is to affect nutrient sensing in a way that convinces our cells to clean themselves up. And what typically, you know, is thought to happen is the cells most in need of damage or things, or I'm sorry, cleanup, or the gunked up proteins most damaged inside a cell, somehow the intelligence in that cellular network says, okay, these are the least important for our function. Let's make a priority of recycling these. So autophagy and senescence would have a lot in common. It's just the degree of stress the cell undergone and the degree of damage that's occurred.
So you have taken this information and created a product from Neurohacker Collective, or at Neurohacker Collective, with the principles you've just talked about. Is that right?
Yeah. We call it Qualia Senolytic. All of our products are Qualia is the name. And the idea of Qualia is a philosophical term that just has to do with the idea of your subjective experience from your senses. So, you know, like classic thing, you know, I'm sighted, my qualia of my environment would be different than an unsighted person, someone that's blind, as an example. But qualia in part because we wanted our products to be experienced, wanted them to be felt. And so with Qualia Senolytic, yeah, we took this, all this pioneering work on senescent cells and senolytics and created a product that is intended to take 2 days a month. And during those 2 days, you do a pretty high dose of the compounds I've mentioned along with some other ones. And the goal is fundamentally that those 2 days a month, you act like the gardener, or these supplements help your body act like the gardener that goes in and finally prunes away some of these senescent cells.
So have you, maybe a better way to ask the question is, I'd love to hear what your own experience has been taking these senolytics.
Yeah, so I'm going on probably like 15 months because I get to take things before they go on sale since I helped design and make them. And honestly, I cut them out before, you know, I would ever, and that we invariably do some small study before we go to market. But our journey is, you know, we research, we create a small batch, me and several other people I can convince trial it. And then, you know, if we feel like, oh, this is, you know, both safe and, you know, doing what we hope, then we move to a bigger study and eventually to market. So my personal experience, I've mostly focused on two things, that kind of like post-exercise, you know, knee inflammation, stiffness, soreness, that, you know, for me, I get a lot more of it at 61 than I did when I was 30, especially if I do squats or things like that. So that's gone way down. And then the other thing for me, so one of the things that happens as we age is our muscles, akin to insulin resistance, but it would be called anabolic resistance. So insulin resistance is this idea that, you know, our tissues don't respond as sensitively to insulin. Anabolic resistance would be that same thing, but to anabolic signals, like, you know, more protein or weightlifting. So it's, you know, very well known that as we get older, our muscles don't respond as well to the things that stimulated health and growth when we were younger. And, you know, that's fundamentally one of the biggest problems with staying functionally healthy as we age, is that, you know, muscle quality pieces. So several now animal experiments have found that anabolic resistance is a big reason, and that senescent cells contribute to that in older animals. And that the last piece, if you do senolytics to clear them out, then the muscles respond much more sensitively to these anabolic signals. So the other piece I've paid attention to is tracking my workouts. Am I still getting stronger? Are my muscles, you know, qualitatively, like, still able to grow when I do things like, you know, have good workouts? And so those have been the main things I've looked at. But a good friend, he's also a chiropractor, as a matter of fact, lives in Florida. He reached out fairly recently. He's been taking Quietus Senolytic since it launched a year ago, June. And he did the pace of aging test through True Diagnostics, which is a DNA methylation, but instead of, you know, predicting how old you are, it's producing the rate, or reporting the rate that it's predicting your aging. So his rate of aging was already excellent when he did his test a year ago before Quietus Senolytic. I think it was about a 0.9. So he was aging at 0.9 years for every, you know, one calendar year. But when he redid it recently, and he's done two things in the last year, Quietus Senolytic once a month, and then the other thing, he's been doing the fasting mimicking diet, Prolon is the brand for that, I think once a quarter. But anyways, his new one was like 0.68. So he was just like, you know, something's really working. I'm going to keep this up. And during this last year, he's launched a website, a book. He's had, in his words, a pretty stressful year from, you know, the commitments he's been honoring. So, and one of the things I try to communicate to people is senescent cells are very much a threshold issue. They don't necessarily accumulate equally in all our tissues as the decades pass. Like some people, it may be their joints. Joints are a classic area where senescent cells cause a lot of problem, because the connective tissue, fibroblasts would be the classic connective tissue cell. Those reproduce quickly and are very prone to becoming senescent. So someone that's already having, because of the passage of time, issues with, you know, joint stiffness or discomfort, they're likely to, you know, experience a senolytic helping with that. Someone that's their same age that doesn't have that issue, you know, obviously they're not going to feel a senolytic in the same way, but maybe cognitively, you know, they're having more mood challenges or something than, you know, they would have had 10 years ago. They may experience, you know, an improvement in their mood. We saw that in one of our small studies. So one of the interesting things of senescent cells is, again, this idea to me of like the you know, we want to keep them below that tipping point where they're causing a tissue now to be dysfunctional and cause then more noticeable problems. So, you know, one thing for your audience is, you know, I would just tell people don't expect necessarily that you'll see something. If a plant has a couple yellow leaves, you know, would the plant, you know, is the plant still, you know, able to survive, grow? Yeah. But, you know, would we want to, you know, get rid of those before two becomes three, three becomes six? And so the, like my goal personally is to periodically prune, and periodic is once a month, is to make sure that my tissues are staying below that threshold where they might then contribute to a problem. Because it's a lot easier to prevent problems than fix them, is, you know, and you would know that. And I'm sure most of the audience, having, you know, the people trying to help them with their challenges would appreciate that as well.
Right. So we've got a different measure, but depending on where the weakest link is, and we've all got that bio individuality where, you know, for you it might be post-workout muscle pain, for me it was joint pain. That's how I knew, that's how I figured out 10 years ago that I needed to not be eating gluten, right? So we've all got something. But for something I'm very interested in for my own prevention due to family history, but also I talk about a lot on this podcast, is protecting a woman's brain function specifically at, you know, midlife and beyond, because neurodegeneration tends to affect women disproportionately to men, for sure. And so how does this cellular aging that you've been talking to us about affect the brain? And, you know, what are your levers that you're going to suggest we pull around that?
Yeah, so the brain... So first, the brain has more than one, like we almost always invariably think of neurons when you think of the brain, right? Like these are the things that make your neurotransmitters, your dopamines and serotonin, right? And neurons, so just like a quick detour, cells, you'll often see like this if you Google it, that the average life of a cell in a human is about 7 years. And then at that point, cells just go through old age and die. They go through apoptosis, right? So it's completely normal that we're churning cells. We have billions and billions of cells go through apoptosis every day. But that 7 year average is misleading, because some cells turn over really quickly. You know, blood cells, it's every 2 months, intestinal cells every couple of days, liver cells, it's about, you know, 1 to 2 years, but heart cells like 40 years. Muscle cells, I think it's 7, fat cells like 14. But neurons were built for a lifetime. We're not supposed to be turning over neurons. The ones they can change their connections to other neurons, right? Neuroplasticity, but we want to keep neurons from becoming damaged and dying, right? So autophagy is crazy important to keep neurons healthy. But then there's all support cells in the brains as well. So these are your astrocytes and microglia and things like that. And those ones do make new versions of themselves, and so can become senescent. And what is thought, whether it's, you know, like mood disorders, like, you know, depression, your anxieties, or PTSD or chronic pain, that all of those things share some of the same underlying, you know, functional issues in the brain, often, you know, low level inflammation, issues with neuroplasticity, brain energetics, and not making enough ATP and these other compounds important. And that senescent cells for sure impact all those things. So, you know, I wouldn't use the word cause, because cause can be elusive, but almost, again, like anything you think of with aging that tends to trend worse, senescent cells have at least some role. And so in brain aging, they would similarly have a big role so far. In animal experiments, a very big role. In human experiments, they're still ongoing for that. And then I think, what to do, you know, so I can just tell you what I do, right? I take our Aquarius senolytic once a month. Through the rest of the month, I think it's important to do lifestyle behavior and potentially supplement things that help our immune system, because at the end of the day, that's what should be cleaning up the straggler senescent cells before they accumulate. And, you know, as we know, the immune system just struggles often as we get older. And lifestyle plays a huge role in that, right? Not getting enough sleep, too much stress, you know, body clock disruption because we're not getting light. Like foundational things almost just have disproportionate ripple effects, whether it's, you know, on being able to, you know, like you mentioned with the lymphatic system, clean up our brain. If we don't get into that great deep sleep and that first sleep cycle of the night, kind of miss the boat on getting that nightly detox. So, you know, I think of supplements as an important, you know, complementary piece, but I know personally, going back 20 years or more, sleep has just routinely been the thing that an average person most struggles to realize, one, its importance. And then if they do realize how important, often, you know, there's just a lot of people that struggle with sleep issues. So trying to improve sleep, I think, is super important and often a challenge when women get into this, you know, perimenopausal age. And then, you know, I think stress, you know, a huge category, right? But Selye, who was one of the big stress researchers, he's the pioneer, the grandfather of the idea, eventually, you know, in his writing at least, suggested that what he found is mental emotional stress was by far the largest source of stress in, you know, in his experiments. And I tend to use a metaphor that goes back to a game my siblings and I had in the late 60s called The Last Straw. But if you Googled the camel game or the last straw game, you'd see it. But it was just this little plastic camel. Each over the back, there was a bucket on one side of the back, a bucket on the other, two teams, and you'd spin this wheel. You know, maybe it pointed to blue, and so you'd have to put one blue straw in your bucket, and the different color straws, some were, you know, heavier than others. And, you know, at some point, one team would put the last straw in, the back would collapse. So that's, when I think of stress, I think of the camel game, right? Like we all, the camel has some degree of resilience, right? That his back can carry so many straws. We don't know how, you know, like your resilience may be different than mine. If I'm sleep deprived, mine's less than it would be if I'm adequately sleep. But all of us have a certain amount of straws we're, you know, walking around with today. Some we share because, you know, maybe EMF, the environment, factors that, you know, aren't really easy to do anything about. But some are things we can do something about. And at the end of the day, none of us will ever know how close we are to that last straw until it's put in our bucket, and then that's when health collapses, right? And then what happens then, just getting rid of that cause, right? That one last straw usually isn't gonna be sufficient to restore the camel's back, right? You have to like clean out a lot of straws now. So when I think of just, you know, me personally and health in general, it's what can I be doing to keep my basket, you know, the load in that as light as possible so that if inadvertently, you know, a big straw gets added in, then I'm not gonna collapse. And I'll have time to deal with that straw. And I just think, you know, that mental emotional is one of the heaviest straws that we have to own as human beings, right? So if we can do things to recognize when we have like something big that's weighing us down in those areas and take, you know, usually requires taking some action, right? I mean, maybe it's working with a counselor, maybe it's making a decision, but removing that straw, right? Because that frees up a lot of weight in the bucket. And now we're more resilient when something inadvertently comes our way. And so, you know, we started this conversation off talking about the cause. You know, I think often we blame that last straw as the cause, which is fair, right? It caused the collapse. But, you know, the truth was there was lots of other straws in the basket that, yes, you know, that had they not been there, that cause would not have caused the issue.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. We're both from generations where we were taught to sort of buck up and not talk about things, not deal with things, not, you know, especially things like mental and emotional stressors, right? And as far as stress management goes, suck it up, buttercup, right? Yeah. So it's so interesting to see how our children and our grandchildren, our nieces, etc., and the younger generations are dealing with this far better than our generations did.
I think you know, better and worse in some ways, right? I think, you know, like there's an aspect of, you know, our thoughts create our reality, right? So when I say mental, emotional, you and I could be exposed to the same thing. So like when I was in naturopathic school, I remember an example, I think it was an MD teaching us a course in radiology, but it was a medical doctor. And he, you know, I'm going to, you know, memories, you know, not great 30 years, but, you know, my recollection of the story was that he started it off and saying, you know, I don't know much about naturopaths, you know, I'm an MD, but I'm super excited, you know, as I teach you this to learn more about what you do, right? So I took it as a compliment personally, right? Like how he said. And at the end of the class, one of my classmates was really angry. And I'm like, well, help me understand like what happened. And she's like, well, he insulted us. I'm like, wow, I didn't hear that. Like, what did he say? And he said, he referred to us as naturopaths instead of naturopathic doctors. So she took that as him belittling our profession. I call us naturopaths. Instead, I focused on like, I'm super excited to learn more about what you guys do, right? So we both had the same experience or exposure, but we created different experiences for ourselves. So I think one of the things that in the current world I worry about a bit is that the stories we're telling ourselves, and this can be all generations, aren't productive stories, right? We're finding opportunities to feel victimized or to feel insulted that really didn't exist. And so, you know, I know my personal goal is to be a good storyteller for myself. If something happens, if someone does something in my environment, like cut them a break, like assume they had a different intention rather than, oh, why did this person insult me? Because if I, you know, if I react like and give them the benefit of the doubt, tell a better story about what they did, I'm not creating much of a straw for myself. But if a day or two later I create this negative story and I'm still stewing over why they, you know, caused this perceived insult, like I am carrying a straw. So I think one of the things I'm definitely, it's not a matter of simply being like, I'm going to push back, I'm not going to suck it up, I'm going to, like, are you sure you're not creating the straw?
Yes. Right?
Like your interpretation, because that's not serving any. And yeah. So I think the first thing for me is like, you know, understanding the brain's very biased to do these, you know, types of things where, oh, it's not me, it's you. And like, I responded emotionally, like who caused it? And this is an old Wayne Dyer-ism, and it was in one of his presentations I saw once, but he starts it off and he asks the audience, okay, what happens when you squeeze an orange? You know, and the audience eventually yells out, well, you know, juice comes out. And then he says, yeah, well, why did the juice come out? And everyone yells, well, it's because you squeezed the orange. And he, you know, pauses for a minute. He's like, no, it came out because the juice was already there, right? If you squeeze an orange without juice, there's no juice, right? And it's that combination. And I guess, you know, at the end of the day, what I worry about is, you know, the world's going to squeeze us, right? And we tend to blame that for, you know, our juice coming out. And my goal, and I'm not always perfect at this, is to understand that at the end of the day, well, someone else might have been squeezed and no juice came out. If juice came out of me, you know, that's my responsibility. And I think that piece, maybe we're not as good, you know, at, as, you know, I don't think we've ever been great as humans at it in my life, but I think we're actually maybe worse than we used to be. It's just too easy to blame someone else.
I love this orange analogy. That's great. That's great. I'm always up for a Wayne Dyer analogy.
Yeah.
This is what my husband would call, don't start none, won't be none. Just to make it as simple as possible. Now, Dr. Kelly, I didn't tell you this, but you are very special to this podcast because you're the first guy that has been featured in 100 episodes.
Wow.
So I want to thank you so much for the science literacy lessons we got today, because I feel read in on these senescent cells and the process of cellular aging in a way that I just wasn't before. You can read the science of it, but you just made it so approachable, and I'm so grateful for that. So thank you for being our first Not Your Mother's Menopause Dude. Dr. Dude.
Well, thank you. What an honor.
Many have approached me, but you're the first one to pass muster. So thank you. And this interview did not disappoint in any way, I think. I'm just so grateful for you sharing your information, for you doing the research and taking that information and making these beautiful products that are very usable. I like that. I know I have a gift package on the way to me, so I'm excited to give these guys a try. And I'll report to my listeners my experience with it. And I thank you for, we've got a coupon code to share as well for anyone who's interested in the products. But I always like to end these conversations by asking you this question. Knowing what you know now, what would you tell your younger self?
So I think the main thing, and this would go back to more understanding my dad. So my dad, you know, I was a child of the 70s, so to speak, right? I lived near the coast outside of Boston. My dad worked in the city, you know, high-end professional job, long, crazy commute, God bless him. And he would come home at the end of the day, you know, he'd get there, say 6:30. He often was fairly, you know, grumpy, right? Like, you know, we had to, you know, definitely knew we had to walk on tippy toes when he came home. And, you know, my younger self would have, you know, like blamed my dad for that, right? Like, you know, it was like something about his character, where the way I currently think about it is, you know, our brain only has so many resources. You know, we're going to have more typically, you know, early in the day than late at day, right? Because we use mental energy and other things as the day progresses. And so the best version of ourselves often is going to be present somewhere early in our day. And by the end of the day, we've used up all those resources and often need an opportunity to recharge. But it's not about our character. It's just fundamentally we're resource, you know, mental energy deficient at that point in time. And so my story now that I tell about my dad is completely different, right? It's like, oh, you know, my dad wasn't this, you know, grumpy, irritable guy. He was someone that, you know, loved us so much that he did this crazy commute, worked really hard, came back at the end of the day, pretty, you know, mental energy depleted. And, you know, and I recall, like, if we gave him an opportunity to shine his shoes and, you know, to fiddle with his hobbies, that, you know, by 7:38, he was a fun guy to watch TV with, right? He just needed that opportunity to recharge. So I guess, long story short, it would be, you know, what I recognize, but what I hope the audience maybe will do as well, is realize I love ones, if they're not showing up their best version of themselves towards the end of their day, not their fault. It, you know, they often just need, like my dad needed, an opportunity for his brain just to recharge, to, you know, fundamentally shift energy that was here and didn't get used to an area that had been overtasked for the day. So, you know, if we're not showing up and being our best self at the end of the day, you know, that's where things like nootropics come in. Those often will help, right? They'll be things that give more resources so that we have more juice to pull on for the entire day. And for those of us that are, you know, like me, with my dad, you know, tell ourselves a better story about that, because the truth is, the better story is, you know, more likely accurate. And it's, you know, I think it's important to be generous, right? To, you know, understand that often things we're blaming on the other person, it's more their circumstances than their character. That would be it. And, you know, with my dad, that's the story I tell. So I have, you know, lovely memories of him, and, you know, have, you know, compared to the younger version of myself, I just think I tell a much more generous, but probably more accurate story about my dad.
As you said earlier in this conversation, be a good storyteller. And I think you just gave a beautiful example. So thank you.
You're welcome.
And Dr. Greg Kelly, thank you for joining us today on the Not Your Mother's Menopause podcast.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Such a wonderful conversation with Dr. Gregory Kelly. I really enjoyed it. And I asked him to come back to speak to us in the new year. So be watching for more content from him and the Neurohacker Collective. Please, if you want to find out more information about their amazing supplements and blends, and Dr. Kelly is the formulator of these blends, please go to www.neurohackercollective.com/notyourmothers. And then you can enter the code NOTYOURMOTHERS in capital letters for 15% off of all of their Qualia formulations. I have been taking the Night formulation and the Mind formulation, and ooh, I like them a lot. So please go and check out the neurohackercollective.com/notyourmothers. And finally, just a reminder to sign up for the Brain Health webinar coming up on September 9th at noon. That's going to be live on Zoom. And the link is below in the show notes. If you want a deeper dive on any of the podcast episodes, you can check out my page on Patreon, which is patreon.com/Dr. Fiona Lovely. On Instagram and TikTok at Dr. Fiona Lovely, and finally on Facebook at Not Your Mother's Menopause Podcast. As always, I'm so grateful for the time that I get to spend with you every couple of weeks, and thank you for listening. I know you get to choose what you spend your time doing, and I'm just so grateful. Today, it was a little bit with me. I hope you have a fantastic day. Talk soon. The views and nutritional advice expressed by Dr. Fiona Lovely are not intended to be a substitute for conventional medical service. If you have or suspect that you have a medical problem, promptly contact your healthcare provider. No information offered here should be interpreted as a diagnosis of any disease, nor an attempt to treat or prevent or cure any disease or condition. As with any new advice or program, you should always contact your healthcare provider prior to starting anything new. Thank you.
Whether you're making the same breakfast that you have every day or baking a cake for an extra special day, eggs are a staple in our diets. Eggland's Best eggs are nutritionally superior to ordinary eggs, containing more vitamins and 25% less saturated fat. Not only are they better for you, but Eggland's Best eggs taste better too. There's a reason that they're America's number one eggs. Visit egglandsbest.com for additional information and delicious recipes.
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries plus napkins plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.